You must stay at home. Stay at home.
Hello, and welcome to Lockdown, hosted by Steve Bomford with Mike Davis-Marks. Our armed forces operate in challenging environments. Week by week, we'll explore what we can learn from their experiences.
Hello, Steve. What have we got in store for our next episode of Lockdown Podcast?
Well, we have a gentleman called Craig Jones, who I don't think you've met. He is the joint chair of Fighting With Pride.
I've heard of Fighting With Pride, but I'm sure that we'll hear a lot more about it during the interval. So this sounds like another interesting journey.
I think it will be. It is most definitely an interesting journey, both for him and the Royal Navy, I think. So let's have a listen. Craig, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast. It'd be great to hear about your story. I have heard this before, but I think you told such a fantastic story. Our listeners are going to be very interested in this. So thank you for agreeing to come on the show.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks for asking me along.
So let's start with your military career. Tell me about that and recount some of these stories that you told me.
Yeah, of course. I went to university in Portsmouth, then Portsmouth Poly. And I chose Portsmouth Poly because I wanted to be near the Navy. It'd always been my ambition to be a Royal Naval officer. My uncle was a radio operator during the 1950s, and somehow that one event made us a naval family. So I came to Portsmouth, passed my Admiralty Board, and joined Britannia Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, on the 13th of September 1989 at 15:45. Yeah. You never forget that stuff. We all carry it with us. It's like a DNA. But for me, there was a complication, and it was a complication from day one. In that, as I walked through the gates at Dartmouth, I knew that I was gay. And I knew that I was gay because I'd walked down Elm Grove in Portsmouth 3 weeks before, and I'd gone past the big newspaper shop there, and I'd gone in and I'd bought a magazine. And I'd taken it back to my digs. And don't look too worried on this discussion, because it's not the magazine you might be thinking of. It was a Radio Times.
Can I just say before you carry on, I'm not, my expertise in some of the magazines that you're alluding to is not probably that good. I will discuss the story with you when we finish recording this, though.
Okay, of course. I realised I bought this copy of the Radio Times because it had a picture of Michael Ball on the front cover. And if the listener's immediately thinking of Edna Turnblad or Sweeney Todd, well, let me tell you that 30 years ago, Michael Ball was quite hot property. And I thought, that's an incredible complication, because 3 weeks time, I'm going to Britannia Royal Naval College, Dartmouth. And that doesn't fit. But it just didn't seem relevant. The only people I thought might be gay were Larry Grayson and perhaps John Inman. And quite frankly, I didn't identify with those people. But what I did identify was this amazing, exciting career that lay ahead of me. And that's what excited me. And I parked all the gay stuff and walked through those gates, and the exciting journey began.
You just said there, park all the gay stuff, like it's kind of something that you can switch on and off. It's kind of who you are, isn't it? Is that, or am I making an assumption here?
I think at 21, it's about where your focus is. And my focus wasn't upon, I couldn't even imagine what it would be like to have a boyfriend.
Right.
The word would have frightened me. I'd never seen a lad who was gay who I would have been attracted to. We all imagine now lots of people in the media who are gay and they're out and, you know, they look wonderful. And I think for young people, there are lots and lots of amazing role models and poster kids, but that just wasn't the case in the 1980s. Those images weren't there. And I was just really focused upon driving ships, being in the Royal Navy and doing all those exciting things. So I got through Dartmouth. It was really flipping hard work, but basic training is supposed to be hard work. And I joined my first ship, HMS Cornwall. I went straight out to the Caribbean, where we were doing boarding operations to do with counter-narcotics interdiction. So straight into that boy's own career, and that was boy's own, not boy's own. And and that was really ace. I loved it. And based on that job going quite well, I retrained as a helicopter fast rope insertion officer. And I led boarding teams in the Northern Arabian Gulf just after the first Gulf War, as they cleared the vessels out of the Shatt al-Arab, and my teams did boardings onto those vessels to check that they were clear of bombs and guns and that sort of stuff. And by that time, I thought I'd join the flipping army, because every time I went and did something, it was in green, not blue. And that continued. And I went out to Northern Ireland as an executive officer on Operation Internet, which was the border patrol in South Down. And we did vehicle checkpoints on the coast roads there, and harbour searches and vessel searches. So both the big stuff, the merchant ferries coming out of Warren Point and Belfast Lock, and also little fishing boats and pleasure boats and stuff, because there was a lot of contraband going, as you can imagine, going from the north to the south, mm-hmm. lots of cigarettes and booze, but there was also bombs and guns. It was, you know, the most challenging times, perhaps, or some of the most challenging times of the Troubles, as we call them. And I had about 2.5 years then, one of the most rewarding parts of my life. I think it was a unique opportunity to stand in the middle of a communities at war with each other and try and restore a bit of calm. I learned a lot about prejudice in Northern Ireland and how divisive it was, things that I stored away for the future. And towards the end of my time there, I had a moment of epiphany. I did an armed boarding on what looked like a deserted fishing boat, like a very large potter with two decks. And I took a Royal Ulster Constabulary sergeant with me, and we hailed it and nobody responded. And then we got on board and it just wasn't right. So we pulled our pistols, and the sergeant very bravely said, "You go down the hatch, sir, I'll cover you." Which seemed more exciting than I preferred. But I put my head down the hatch, and down below, there were two older teenagers in each other's arms, teenage lads in each other's arms on a mattress. And I was immediately shocked by the image, but also immediately protective. Even though I couldn't really say I was part of that community, it was just something stirred. And luckily I had body armor on and a goon suit, and it wasn't difficult to fill the hatch, so the IUC officer couldn't see. And I beckoned them to get their kit on, because of course this is well before the age of consent was reduced from 21. So this is illegal, even though had they been heterosexual, then they would have been well within the age of consent.
Yeah.
So they came up top and we questioned them as we did in those days. And I went back to the ship afterwards with the IUC officer. And I went up to my cabin supposedly to write the signal up, because we wrote a signal after every boarding operation. And I sat at my desk and I put my head in my hands and I thought, here I've just seen two young men having the courage to be their true selves, to live an honest life, or as honest as they could be. And here I was with my body armor and my gun and my tin hat, really not having the courage to be myself. And I left Northern Ireland about 6 weeks after that with a degree of resolve that I had to find a pathway in life which was a little bit more rewarding and fulfilling and had more colour in it than I'd achieved so far, and had a little bit of honesty to it as well. So I walked into my first gay bar on the 5th of February 1995. And that's not that I particularly fix on dates, but that was the day that I met my husband. who I've been with for 28 years. So I think that brings military efficiency to dating. First bar, first boy, husband, done.
So your husband was your first partner?
Yes.
Wow.
First person I met, really. But on that day, life moved from monochrome to Technicolor, as you can probably imagine. Never, ever have your first girlfriend or boyfriend or partner at the age of 25. It's a ridiculous age. And it just means that all of that drama that you should do at the age of 13 or 14 just gets delayed, and it's far worse. But actually, it was a day of great happiness, but it was the first day when I started to have to look over my shoulder, looking always and every day for the day when I'd be tapped on the shoulder by the Special Investigation Branch of the Royal Military Police or the Provost Marshal. Because on the 5th of February 1995, if caught, I would have been arrested, court-martialed, and sent to prison for 6 months for the military criminal offence of homosexuality. And that was a great fear for me. My parents had understandably developed a notion that I would marry an admiral's daughter, have two kids called Charlotte and Henry, and a black Labrador. And that wasn't going to happen. And I knew that they would be fearful. And in the end, I took home a 6'3" coffee shop assistant from Tesco with stubble. And that was a bit of a journey for the first 12 months. Although I'm thrilled to say that Adam became an amazing son for my parents. But as many LGBT plus people will tell you, that sometimes takes time, and sometimes it doesn't happen, which is a great sadness. So we had, Adam and I had an amazing first year together. It was incredible. I had a lot of leave after Northern Ireland because I'd done a long tour. So that was great. And I retrained in navigation in the autumn, and I was sent to be the navigator of HMS Sheffield, which I was really excited about. I absolutely loved being an officer of the watch and driving ships. It was a really exciting thing for me to do. And I joined in the January, really ready for the job. But we were due to sail, I think, in the third week of January. And 48 hours before we were due to sail, Adam's father dropped dead suddenly, heart attack. And it threw life into complete chaos. Mm. And I found myself in a situation whereby I now had a family to protect. But that family was a foreign and alien thing to the Royal Navy, which is not something that the service should ever be proud of. Actually, the armed forces are amazing at looking after personnel when there is a crisis, when things go wrong. But for me, in crisis, the only thing that would happen if I revealed that crisis would be that two provost marshals of my own rank would come on board and march me down the gangway to prison. So I knew that I'd get Sheffield out of harbour, but instinctively I knew that I wouldn't bring her home. The memory is a little hazy, but about 8 hours after leaving Plymouth Sound, I was casuvacked by helicopter to Derriford Hospital, to a mental health unit, which was an immense, difficult time. But in my own mind's eye, it was just a young officer with far too much to manage in far too short a period of time. After a couple of days, they sent me to see a surgeon captain psychiatrist who, quite frankly, was far more mad than I was. It was almost as though he said, "I think your underpants are too tight." But anyway, go home. He said, "Go home and have a rest for a few weeks, and I'm sure it'll all be fine." And that's what happened. I was sent home. In many ways, what would have happened had circumstances been different. So I got home. We, buried the father. Adam went back to college, having broken it for a while, and life stabilized. And but sadly, that meant a bad mark, really, against my career, which would blight me for some years afterwards. And it's funny, just as an aside to that, we were pretty tired by then, and it was half term. So we said that we'd have a quick holiday somewhere, and we tended to holiday in strange places because there was no chance of you meeting anybody else. And we booked a holiday to that famous gay destination of the Gambia. Which I don't know what I was thinking of, but anyway, so we arrived in the Gambia, and I'm at this beach bar. And to be honest, I was a bit down then. We'd had a rough time, you know, I'd blighted my career and all sorts of stuff. And I was sat at the bar feeling sorry for myself. And a young lad, roughly my age, came up to me and he said, "You look really, really miserable." He actually used an expletive, but anyway. And I said, I looked at him, I didn't know anything about him. And I said, "Oh, if you want the honest truth," I've never done this before. I said, "If you want the honest truth, it's because I've got one of those," and I pointed at Adam, who was on a sun lounger, and I flipped my wallet open and I said, "And I've got one of those," and I pointed at my ID card. And he said, "Then you've got problems, but they're not as bad as mine." He said, "The boy that your partner's talking to is my partner." And he flipped open his wallet and he had a Royal Military Police ID card. And he was Sergeant Darren Ford, RMP, who is a lovely, lovely man. And sadly, about 9 months after that meeting, the boy he was with at the time reported him to the military police as their relationship broke up. So a great loss to the service, because he's was an amazing soldier. Anyway, let me fast forward a little bit. In penance, after a couple of months off, I was sent to the aircraft carrier Illustrious as Navigator 5. And for listeners that don't know what the job of Navigator 5 is, it's the person that sharpens the pencils for Navigator 4. So it was a bit of a penance, if you like. So that their concept was that I'd had a crisis of confidence of not being able to navigate the ship. And that was just the way it had to be. And I think in the years that followed, I just became very angry at the injustice. Part of the background to people who join the service is that you should believe in equality and human rights and freedom and want to defend the values of the United Kingdom. And the ban just was not the values of the United Kingdom, not even in the 1980s. So, and I watched colleagues being marched down the gangway to a fate that was grey, actually, because we never talked about it. So the ban was never discussed. It was a toxic subject in the wardroom. And I suppose I mentally prepared myself for the day when I would have a voice. I knew that that day would come. And in early January 2000, I knew that the court cases had been ruled against the Ministry of Defence, and I knew that the lifting of the ban was imminent. So when I was called up to the main communications office in my ship on the 10th of January 2000 to receive a signal, I wasn't surprised when I read it. So the signal came in ABA, commanding officer only, marked sensitive, and I was the head of communications. So I took the signal in a pack to the captain's cabin and, like all good communications officers, read it on the way through. So I kind of knew what was there. And I handed it to him and he said, "Sit down." And he read the signal and he said, "I can't believe, Craig, that the Mandarins of Whitehall will force us to serve with these people."
Oh my God.
And it was just an immensely difficult conversation. And in that moment, I really wasn't sure how to react. I was standing in front of a very senior leader. This is a big ship, 500 people on board. And I just thought to myself, these are not the values that I learned at Dartmouth or had learned in my career to that date.
Mm.
And he asked me to get the heads of department together, which I did. And
didn't you feel like reacting? How did you remain? I mean, I know training and discipline's part of all of this, but as an individual, as a person, how did you make them calm when someone's saying something like that?
Well, I am actually quite a reactionary person, actually. But in that moment, I knew that the destination wasn't necessarily going to be completed on that day. But I also knew that my moment would come very quickly.
Okay.
And also there was only him and me in the room, and that just, it didn't feel right to respond at that time. So I got the heads of department up, and the ops officer isn't a head of department, but he often joins. So I stayed while the captain had the same discussion with the heads of department. And they agreed a plan. This was on the Tuesday. They agreed a plan to tell the wardroom, the officers, at midday on the Wednesday, just before lunch. And then we would clear the lower deck. So gather the whole ship's company together in the hangar on the Thursday at 1300, which would be an hour before it was announced in the Commons at the end of Prime Minister's question time. And so I listened to this disappointment speech again on the Wednesday to the whole of the officer corps. And I think at that moment, I just realised that I could not stand and listen to that message being given to the 500 men and women with whom I was serving, because some of them would be LGBT plus.
Mm.
And for them, that day would be the beginning of the end of a dreadful journey. A dreadful journey of prejudice and of victimization and of fear, living in fear. So that speech could not happen. So I went to see the second in command and told him that in 5 minutes' time I was going to go up and come out to the captain, which caused a degree of chaos. He pleaded with me not to do it, but you can probably imagine there was a fire in my soul anyway, and I'd been waiting for this moment. I was absolutely determined that the men and women who had fought for us in the European court would not be let down by not having a voice that went beyond the years of the ban.
Mm.
So I went to see him, and it was a very difficult conversation. But I said quite clearly to him that that speech had no place in our Royal Navy. And slightly dramatically, I remember saying that we were the sons and daughters of Nelson, which is our tradition in the Royal Navy. We remember the immortal memory of a man who was deemed to be one of the greatest leaders of all time, and a man who is famous for loving and having a regard for the men and women under his command. And that was a day to remember that immortal memory. He was quite shocked by that discussion. And it was a fairly brief conversation, and I left them to continue it without me there. And it set us up for quite a difficult relationship. But I didn't slow down from there. I put my foot on the gas. So a week later, with slightly more comedy, a chit went up on the notice board for Burns Night. And I put my name on this chit along with, and it had a name for partner, so I put Adam's name on. Absolute chaos ensued. So I got called up to the commander's cabin, first of all, to ask if I'd be dancing with Adam. It's Burns Night, it's a Cayley, everybody dances, you know, and you don't sort of glide around the ballroom in each other's arms. That's not the deal. But I think that was the image that was imagined. And I said, well, it's Burns Night. Of course we'll be dancing, but not in that way.
Yeah.
It was just kind of, what? And then there were also a few questions asked about Adam, which was quite funny. I think they imagined, I don't know what they imagined, but I had to explain to them that my husband actually looked like them.
Oh, dear me. You know, I mean, it's funny now, isn't it? But crikey.
I mean, I think they're imagining feather boas something or something of that nature. But what was amazing to see in that ship was that over the months, something that was very foreign to an awful lot of people became a very comfortable thing. I mean, in the first few months, there were people that refused to have showers in the same block. And, you know, people who didn't really talk to me very much. Such was the indoctrination of our people in those days. But I think people got to know me. They got to know Adam. And in some way, shape or form, they came to realize that actually it wasn't that different. Mm. And that was great. But I then turned to the fact that the inclusive policy would never realize its full potential unless it was properly supported. And it wasn't properly supported for some years. It was a toxic subject still. We still had lots of people leaving the armed forces because they were LGBT plus after the ban, because it was such a dreadful environment to work in. And I started campaigning to try and get some resolve to support the diversity business case. If we believe that a ship is manned by the best team in the field, then we don't cut 10% of those people out just because we don't like their orientation. It's irrational. Yeah. So my point was that actually we needed to recruit and retain LGBT plus people. We needed to recognize that they had talents to add. So I started letter writing because that was the only way I could do it. I wrote a paper called LGBT Way Forward for the Armed Forces, which went down like a lead balloon. I sent it to Second Sea Lord in October of that first year of the ban. And when I look back on it, it was a very sensible document which suggested that we joined Stonewall's Diversity Champion Scheme and that we created employee network groups and that we created an annual conference. And they were exactly the things that we did 5 years later. But it was a document that at the time was very, very unpalatable. So that didn't get anywhere. So I started writing letters, and I wrote letters to Secretary of State, to the Prime Minister, to the First Sea Lord, to the Minister for Defence People, all sorts of people. And unfortunately, there are a few lines in Queen's regulations that say you can't do that. But I kept ignoring that. And it did make me a little unpopular. It was quite difficult to find anybody who was prepared to stand anywhere near me at the bar in those days. But it was important. In those days, there were 50,000 people in the Royal Navy. And I felt some sense of responsibility to those more junior than I and less, you know, less fortunate than I, who were having a really rough time. So it came to a head in about 2004 when Second Sea Lord decided to have a Captains of Industry Diversity Conference at Collingwood. And by then I was the officer in charge of the comms warfare training unit at Collingwood. And they had it in the gym, and there were about 150 people there from all sorts of different industry and commerce and government people, quite senior people. So the head of Ford Motor Crowns Europe and senior civil servants. And I snuck in through the fire door when they were about to get to the panel session. And the panel was being led by Second Sea Lord. And when they got to the Q&A, I nearly leapt out of my seat in such a way that actually everybody turned round. So Second Sea Lord didn't have a choice. He said, the lieutenant commander at the back, because he couldn't see me because there was all lights on. And it was a bit of a Mr. Smith goes to Washington moment. So I basically said, sir, it's been wonderful to hear about what we're doing for people with different race and faith and ethnicity and gender and disabilities and for women in the service. But we have a part of our wonderful armed forces community about which we dare not speak their name. And it's the LGBT plus community. And why has your department done nothing to ensure that we value these folks and they're included? And it didn't go down brilliantly.
No, it's not the best way to start a popularity contest, is it?
No, it wasn't ideal. But luckily, Surinder Sharma was on the stage from Ford. And bless him, he stood up and said, maybe something needs to be done. And he said, look, you know, we're a commercial organization, but we sponsor Pride in London. It's one of the places that we sell the most cars. Surely, Second Sea Lord, you have a diversity business case. But it didn't help me that much, because the next day I got a letter in green ink expressing displeasure.
What's the significance of the green ink?
Well, Admiral's writing green ink.
Oh, okay.
Their signature block. So a letter of admonishment. And it wasn't the only one I got over those years, but this was June. And on the Saturday, it's funny how life works out sometimes. It's amazing how just one moment of chance can change things so enormously. Adam and I had got tickets out of a raffle for Troop in the Colour. It was no act of kindness by anybody. It was literally a raffle. So I put my best uniform on, and Adam hired a morning dress thing, meaning a suit. we popped along, and I sat down next to a lovely looking old fella who looked quite stately. His morning dress didn't look like he just hired it from Don & Co. And I sat down I'd been there for about 5 minutes, and he turned around to me and he said, hello, Commander, which was rather nice because I was a Lieutenant Commander. He said, how's your week been? And I said, sir, my week has been really, really appalling. And there was an expletive in there as well. And he said, well, I've seen Troop in the Colour 25 times over the years, and it's quite dull now. I think your story might be more exciting. And I spent an hour and a half talking to him about why I thought the armed forces was missing a moment, and why I thought that the LGBT plus community deserved better, and why I felt that it was a denigration of leadership to have allowed these circumstances to happen. And he said, well, he kind of agreed. He was clearly a small C conservative man, but he kind of got it. Mm. And the long and the short is that he introduced himself at the end of Troop in the Colour, and he turned out to be Lord Armstrong of Ilminster, who was the cabinet secretary to Margaret Thatcher's administrations, and probably the most important civil servant of the second half of the 20th century. He was amazing. I went out for lunch with him afterwards, and he said he'd do what he could. And 2 weeks later, we received an invite to go to Leeds Castle for a weekend, which was clearly going to be a posh do. It was a whole weekend, and there were lots and lots of different meals and lots of different rigs that we had to take. And we arrived on the Friday lunchtime, and we drove our battered Rover up to Leeds Castle. I've never seen the staff get rid of a car so quickly. It was the fastest that that car had ever moved. So we got out, we grabbed our luggage, and this battered old Rover was out the gate like a rocket. And we went up, got changed for the first meal, which was in dog robbers, jacket and trousers. And we walked out of our room at the castle, and I walked straight into First Sea Lord and his wife. And essentially, Lord Armstrong had brought us together for the weekend. And that was then Admiral Lord West of Spithead. It was just an amazing opportunity. And I spent the whole weekend talking to Admiral Allen and Lady Rosie about my ideas about how we could be a better, fitter, more welcoming and kinder armed force for people who are LGBT plus, and why that was the future. And again, he understood it. I don't think he'd had other voices saying the same thing, but it was fairly obvious to him. And in consequence, the Royal Navy changed quickly, and the others followed our wake, which was great to see. So we joined Stonewall's diversity champions. We marched in number one uniform at Pride that year, which was an amazing advancement. There were still problems. So as First Sea Lord said, we'll march in number ones. The army said we won't march, and the RAF said we'll wear polo shirts. But to his great credit, Admiral Allen and his successor, Jonathan Banns, said, we are an armed force and we will not march through our capital city in polo shirts. That story was a great risk, but we scampered round with our little team and we spoke to every gay hack in Fleet Street and made damn sure that the story was reported in a great way. And I think that was very influential on the army and the RAF's decisions later. And we gathered the community at Amport House. The First Sea Lord allowed us to put out a Defence Council instruction, so everybody heard that there was going to be an LGBT plus conference. And that was very moving. It was the first time that most of us had been in the company of so many LGBT plus armed forces personnel. There were 60 of us there. It was amazing. Quite an emotional experience for many. And with the support of Stonewall, we've taken the armed forces to a place whereby today, I think it's fair to say that the UK armed forces are the best in the world at LGBT plus inclusion. I think it's a huge achievement. And I met Admiral Tony Radakin 2 weeks ago and congratulated him on an incredible achievement and something that's made our armed forces so much better.
Mm.
And something that fits our values. It's brilliant. But with some sadness, I note that whilst there's been incredible change in the armed forces, nothing has happened for the LGBT plus veterans most affected by the years of the ban.
Mm. You know, we've been going for 6 or 7 years doing workshops, and one of the very first veterans we worked with, myself and Rachel are civilians, we've never served, and he told us a story of it, of being forced to leave the Royal Navy, and we just couldn't believe our ears. It just felt like it was something that came out of Nelson's time, you know, a long, long time ago. Those sort of things happened long distance in the past. So it was quite an eye opener, I have to say.
It's quite shocking, and it's worth mentioning because people don't. We weren't allowed to talk about this. Mm. So when people left the ship, they were never spoken about again. Nobody kept in contact. You couldn't have gay friends because if you had gay friends, the next thing you get is a knock on the door from the SIB asking why you've got gay friends.
Yeah.
So what happened to people was hidden, but it was pretty bad. If you were arrested, if somebody suspected, you were taken away. People were subjected to 2 or 3 days of questioning while they were worn down until they confessed. After confession, they were taken in accordance with Defence Council instructions, they were taken to a military hospital for a medical inspection that has no place in medicine. And then they came back to court-martial. At court-martial, they were convicted and sentenced to 6 months in prison, military prison. And just before they were sent down, they had their medals ceremonially ripped from their uniforms. And as they were marched out of detention quarters 6 months after being imprisoned, they were dismissed in disgrace from Her Majesty's forces, and they had the top corner of their record cards clipped just so that everybody would know that those were the circumstances. And that removed from people their military family. It outed them to their own families, who often didn't respond very well. They lost their pensions, they lost their finances, and most of them lost their peace of mind. And that's it's really sad. When we think about the fact that these people stepped forward for military service and were treated quite so disgracefully. And that's why we've created the charity Fighting With Pride, really.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. So let's fast forward to the present day and talk about Fighting With Pride, because you continue to work, don't you?
Yeah, I'm a completely failed retiree. It's been a dismal failure. So I had a business after my naval career, and I sold it in 2017, and found myself twiddling my thumbs, which I've never been good at. And then I thought that I was concerned that the story of the amazing careers of the years of the band were being lost. So I brought together a group of people, 10 people, who all wrote a chapter, and we called that book Fighting With Pride. In fact, actually, the publishers wanted to call it Rainbow Warriors, and they were really keen on it, but I had to explain to them that I didn't think a military community would particularly like the word Rainbow Warriors, which is, of course, the name of the Greenpeace ship.
Yeah.
Bless them. So, but the book has some of the amazing stories of the band. Darren Ford, who I mentioned, the Royal Military Police Officer story is in there. Elaine Chambers, who was the founder of Rank Outsiders. Ed Hall, who led the Legal Challenge Group. But also people who serve today. So Commander Rowley Woods, who is in Fleet Operations, and two other officers from the Royal Air Force and the Army. But when we got to the end of the book and we were ready to launch, we realized that as a collective, we were angry. We were angry about the fact that nobody has gone back to pick up our fallen, for those who have struggled in the years beyond the ban, and who live lives which are not those that we would wish of any veteran. Mm. So we formed a charity at the Palace of Westminster on the 20th anniversary of the lifting of the ban, and expected to be chained to the railings again. We expected the trials and tribulations of 2000. We expected to have years of petitioning to try and get support from the military charities and from the government and from all organizations that support veterans. And by gum, how wrong we were. Mm. The support for Fighting With Pride has been profoundly moving. Every door that we have knocked on, I've learned now that you can check if the door's open before you charge it. and they have all been open, which is amazing. That our founding partners were the Royal British Legion and SAFR and Stonewall and NHS England, who signed up to support us from day one. The risk aversion that once surrounded this whole subject of LGBT plus people in the armed forces has clearly melted, which has been absolutely fantastic. In my first phone call with Lieutenant General Sir Andrew Gregory, the Chief Executive of SAFR, he volunteered to be our patron after about 120 seconds. And he's been an incredible patron. And our journey is beginning to make a difference. So the government announced the policy on the return of medals in February this year, which is brilliant to see. And we're in discussions with the Cabinet Office for Veterans Affairs about a range of reparations, which will seek to support our LGBT plus veterans to come back to the armed forces family from which they were removed. Mm. And there are some difficult stuff in there. We are talking about compensation. We're talking about looking at their pensions again. And we're talking about stuff that costs money, education and training and resettlement. But these are simply to replace what was taken away from them and taken away from them wrongfully. We need to remember that the European Court ruled that the ban was illegal. But we're also looking at stuff which will support people with their dignity and help them remember that they are veterans. So people who were removed from the retired list of officers should be restored. People who had commissions and warrants ripped up should get those back if that's what they want. People should get their medals back. There's still lots of people who need that to happen. And people should feel welcome.
So for our listeners that maybe have experienced some of these challenges that you're talking about, and there's obviously a great number of issues that could have manifested because of these circumstances, how can you help? How can the charity help? What do they need to do?
Well, we absolutely want to hear from them. We want them to be on our mailing list. We want them to get our monthly newsletters and our notices. We want to make sure that as reparations discussions continue, that they're connected to that.
Yeah.
And we want to support them as well. We're here to signpost and to connect our veterans to the service charities.
Because our experience, as I'm sure you're going to say the same thing is here, is there is often more support out there than people realise for all different aspects of life. And I think that's often the great challenge, is actually getting people to come forward, because there is clearly, well, not clearly, I sense there'll be a stigma still about coming forward with issues that may have happened quite, you know, quite a while ago. So the encouragement of people to come forward is really, really important, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And there are special reasons why these folks won't come forward. So if you imagine that you were dismissed from Her Majesty's forces in disgrace, you have good reasons to not step forward to any organisation that has a crown above the door. Many LGBT plus veterans turned to the military charities in the 70s, 80s and 90s, and they were turned away because most of the charities had a policy of not supporting people who were dismissed in disgrace.
Yeah.
That clumped us along with arsonists and people who committed acts of violence. And if you've been turned away, you're not likely to go back. So a really important part of our work is about capacity building a welcome in veterans charities and building the confidence of our LGBT plus veterans to step forward. So if the veterans step forward to us, we will make extra sure that they are connected to parts of our big charities and small charities, actually, where we know that that warm welcome exists and where we can get help. Because I think we're missing the opportunity of early intervention for so many people. Let's get these folks connected. Let's sort out the housing issues. Let's sort out financial issues and family issues and get people counselling and talking therapies and all those things that will help them begin their recovery, because time has stood still for lots of folks in this community.
Yeah. I mean, I can't begin to imagine how hard that must be. But I think, you know, the work that you're doing here is fantastic and well done. I don't need to say to you, keep going. I think that's a given. I think everybody, our listeners, will have gathered that by now. If you could send me any details, any links of information that you want people to have, we can put that in the description beneath the podcast. So the more the better. But I'd just like to say thank you very much. And I think I get the sense you may have told that story a few times, but you tell it like you're telling it the first time. And I really like that. So thank you very much.
No, it's a pleasure. It's really nice to get the message a bit further out. But it's been lovely to chat to you.
Brilliant. Thank you. Well, Mike, I promised you an interesting journey, didn't I?
I have to give it to you. You do actually provide a very diverse and fascinating set of interviewees. And here's another one who actually I haven't met, as you correctly said, but the journey he's been on, both inside the Navy and then since he left, is really spellbinding, actually, I thought.
It is, and quite a surprising story as well. Lots of, if you like, twists and turns in the story.
Absolutely. I mean, I know that I probably bored you with this before, but I was in the Navy. I joined the Navy in 1977, and of course, at that point, there was a ban on same-sex couples, and a kind of, you know, so we know it now, robbed of a sizable proportion of talent in the UK at the time because of the ban, but also, and I think this comes out through Craig's story, actually suppressing those that were brave enough to serve, but not disclose the fact that they were gay, and actually, you know, affecting them quite severely, Well, I'm glad we are where we are now. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. But the sort of contradictions that kind of creates when you can't come out, but you want to serve your country. But I think, you know, he's told that story really well, really well.
Really well. He told us that he joined the Navy. I think he said 1989, because he came from a naval family. His grandfather had been a radio operator. That's fantastic in its own right. Joined the Navy because he really wanted to serve. But he knew at the time that he was gay. And he also knew, obviously, that there was a ban on same-sex couples in the armed forces at the time. And there was no, I think, prospect then of it likely to be lifted. It was, you know, unimaginable that it might be lifted within the timescale that it was. So that was a very brave thing to do. And I love the way he described how he knew he was gay, was because he thought Michael Ball was hot property.
I know. It was when I was talking to him about it. I mean, obviously, I could see him when we do the interview, and he was trying to sort of get across that, you know, Michael Ball was probably a bit hotter than he is now. He was trying to convince me.
Well, I can understand you needing to be convinced, but I think we ought to make sure that Michael Ball gets to hear this story, because I think he'd be tickled by it, actually, that he was he was the subject of such attraction at the time. But there you go. No, actually, I thought that his story of, you know, the ships he served in and how he went about his business was really quite fascinating. But what really brought it home was when he talked about that he went on holes to Gambia, I think, and he met up with somebody else. And he was clearly at the point, that crossroads, when he was trying to reconcile two very conflicting value systems in his head about service and being open and honest with himself. And he was talking to someone at the bar that said, look, I'm really having problems with this. These two things are incompatible, ID card and the person he turned out to be revealing to was a member of the Royal Military Police who had the same issue. I thought that what a small world that was.
So would I be right in thinking that the Royal Military Police would be policing that as well?
Yeah, they would have been. Well, they're the Army's policemen. The Royal Navy has the regulator branch that does the same thing. But they would have been enforcing the ban. That would have been one of their duties. So the fact that one of the enforcers was also gay and in self-conflict was really interesting, actually.
I can't begin to imagine what that must have been like.
No, I don't think you and I ever will, to be honest. I think the whole of the story then pivoted around this time when he was a communications officer, I think, on a big ship, and he received a sensitive signal that was for the CO's eyes only, the commanding officer's eyes only. And as he said, like every comms officer, he read it, so he knew what it was about. And then he presented to the CO, who read it, told him to sit down, and then opined that he didn't know how the Whitehall Mandrels would allow that to happen. So rather than say, we're making progress, we're moving forwards, this is a good thing, he basically took out his dirty washing, washed it in public. This is the CO I'm talking about. And I think that probably was the lighting of the blue touch paper.
Yeah.
For Craig. The point at which where these two competing values clashed so much that he couldn't stay quiet for any longer, and he didn't. And I can't imagine what was going through his head and the bravery that required to first go to the XO and then say to the CO, you cannot make that statement, as you said it, to the ship's company. I cannot be part of that. That was a turning point for him, and I thought he told it brilliantly, actually.
He did indeed. I bet they don't teach that at Dartmouth, how to handle situations like that, or at least I wouldn't have thought they do.
No, they teach lots of situations, but I don't think that one cropped up. And then he talked about... So obviously that was the end of his naval career. I mean, and he wrote lots of... He became an activist at that point, I think. He decided that actually, you know, he wasn't going to rest on his laurels. He was going to do something about it because there were, in his words, lots of people like him that were suffering inside the service. And there were lots of people that had been kicked out, you know, dishonorably discharged, who were suffering because of that. And he wanted to right that wrong. And I think he has spent the remainder of his life today doing exactly that. And Fighting a Pride, of course, is a charity that was set up exactly to do that.
Yeah, started with the book, didn't it? Which was a collection of stories that he talks about called Fighting with Pride. That's where it all started for him.
Exactly that. And you now know that Admirals write with green ink. I've had a few letters written in green ink to me myself during my naval career. Not for anything good I've done, I can tell you. Maybe that's for another podcast, but Why they write in green ink, I got no idea. But if it's green ink, you know it's come from an admiral.
So if we discovered a naval tradition, or as rather Craig told us about a naval, told me about a naval tradition that you don't know about.
To be honest, I don't know why it's traditional for admirals to use green ink. I just know that they do. So I'm going to go and beaver away after this and find out.
Or if any of our listeners know why, then let us know.
Yeah, what a great idea. Let's get them doing the homework rather than you and me.
Doing some work, yeah.
Yeah, so there's another phrase I think that needed explaining, because he talked about dog robbers. And dog robbers is civilian attire that's worn where the jacket and the trousers don't match. That's what dog robbers is. You know, normally it's a blazer and chinos, or a sports jacket and you know, moleskins. That's traditionally what dog robbers is.
And why are they called dog robbers?
That's another question we need to ask the audience.
Ooh, we've got to have a few questions for this one, haven't we?
Yeah, we need to set them more, and they're not working hard enough from my perspective. We need to get the audience more involved. So if you know why dog robbers are called dog robbers, answers on a postcard, or better still, Twitter feed, to Company Makers, please.
Yeah, please don't use a postcard. It'll never get to us.
Anyway, let's go back to the story that Craig was painting. And he's now left the Navy. You know, he's had the bravery of coming forward and you know, and making, trying to get people to be honest about it. But nothing much happened. I think he said that, you know, he wrote lots of stuff, but nothing much happened until he went to Troop in the Colours and met a very senior civil servant called Lord Armstrong, who would rather listen to his story rather than watch Troop in the Colour, because he'd been so many times, and introduced him through an event at Leeds Castle to the then First Sea Lord, Admiral Sir Alan West, Lord West as he is now. And I think that point is where, for the Navy, everything changed.
It certainly did, didn't it?
Yeah, because although the ban had been lifted, there were so many things that are still unrighted, you know, a wrongs unrighted, that and I think, you know, under Alan West's leadership, the Royal Navy joined Stonewall. He ordained that they should march in uniform during London Pride, which the first of the armed forces to do that. Neither the army nor the RAF did. And I remember watching that actually at the time and thinking, I was director of PR at the time, and I was thinking, how I'm so pleased that we were the first to do that. And that attracted a lot of acclaim for the Navy in taking a bit of leadership here. And that comes down to the First Sea Lord, Alan West, at the time, you know, saying this is what it should be done. And he was followed by Admiral Sir Jonathan Band, who actually had exactly the same attitude. So that policy continued, and the Navy was, you know, first amongst the armed forces to really be proactive rather than reactive. And that's a good thing.
It absolutely is. We've talked about getting Alan West on this podcast, haven't we?
Well, I do believe the very distinguished CEO of the Royal Navy, Royal Marines Charity, suggested that. And perhaps this is the tipping point that we extend an invitation. So, Lord West, if you're listening, we want you on the show.
We do indeed, and he might know about the green ink, of course.
He absolutely would. Anyway, so I think that the whole of this underlines the importance of diversity and inclusion in armed forces. Our armed forces are there to protect, defend our country and its subjects, its people, and must therefore represent those people by being of the people. And so the more the armed forces represent the people, you know, by being like them, the better. And so I think the armed forces, you know, the ban was lifted, what, in 2000, January 2000? That's 21 years ago. It doesn't seem that long ago. But I think we've come a long way in that 21 years, to the point where actually, where we stand now, it's kind of unthinkable that we did have a ban. you know, only 21 years ago. So I think we've come a long way. And I acknowledge, I think, from Craig's testimonies that we haven't got there yet. There are a lot of people who were discharged from the armed forces for not being straight, and didn't get a pension, had their medals taken away from them, weren't given any rights, and it's a long journey to try and, you know, try and give them back that. And of course you can't really undo the mental harm that's been done through the process, but at least we can, with organisations like Fighting for Pride, try our best.
I couldn't agree more, Mike.
So, Steve, I think actually the honest thing is, if any of our listeners have been affected by what's been said, then please come forward and you know, there's support there for you. Fighting with Pride, the Royal Navy, Royal Marines Charity, there are other organisations too, but please come forward.
Absolutely. And as always, we will put the contact details, website, so on and so forth, in the description below.
Another cracking episode, Steve. Well done.
Thank you very much. Green ink. See you next time.
Thanks for listening. The Royal Navy and Royal Marines Charity exist to support sailors, Marines and their families for life. If you or someone you know could do with some support, give them a call on 023 9387 1568 or drop them an email on support@rnrmc.org.uk. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more, please subscribe.